Go Terpins, with Travis Garrison on the Field of 68 Networks. I got Mr. Don Marcus joining me today, a former reporter for the Baltimore Sun, covered a lot of Maryland basketball and sports. How you doing, sir? Happy holidays.
You too, Travis. Good to be with you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for taking time out your busy day. I know it's holiday time, you know, but I'm glad you made some time for me to join my show today.
No, I'm looking forward to it. Obviously, there's a lot about the Terps in the news right now, both with the basketball team going through the transition and sort of a shocking mid-season transition. You know, all the years I covered college sports, I never saw something like that unfold the way it did in college, you know, in College Park. And then, you know, obviously with the football team going to a bowl game after 6 years. So there's a lot of eyes and interest on the Terps.
Absolutely. Now, you've been covering the Terps since 85. So you've been at the Baltimore Sun since 85, correct?
I was, yeah. I was there from 85, and I took a buyout in February 7th of 2020 was my last day, and a month later, everything shut down.
So, wow.
Yeah. It's funny. I ended up taking a buyout during the middle of that season, and I was willing to stay, but because of the way the whole buyouts were, you know, the contracts were written, I had to leave, and people didn't know if I was still alive because I, you know, I left, and all of a sudden my byline disappeared, and I got a lot of calls saying, "Are you okay?" You know, and I explained it, you know, and I actually tweeted it out on that Monday, but even those people who didn't see it said, "Like, what happened to you? You missed the Illinois game." So. Anyway, but it was weird. It was strange, but no, it was a good move.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've seen a lot of the transition in that Maryland back to Coach Giselle days, Coach Williams, Wade, Gary, and now Coach Turgeon. So when you first started out, actually, did you ever cover, you covered Len Bias back then?
Or that was my first year on the beat was Len's senior year. And I tell the story about how I had been working in the New York area covering the Big East, and how I had just finished covering Chris Mullin for 4 years, and I had been around Patrick Ewing, you know, because I was one of the few, you know, reporters that John Thompson trusted and brought into the sort of, you know, not, he never brought everybody into the inner circle, but we got a peek of the inner circle, you know, the Hoya paranoia thing and everything. But, you know, and I was even covered Michael Jordan a bit because my first Final Four was 1982 when he hit the shot to beat Georgetown. And I spent some time with him the following season. And I'll tell you something. I knew who Len Bias was. I heard of him when I got there. But I never experienced anything like what I saw on that court that season. I said he was Jordan, you know, coming out of college. I said he was Jordan with a jump shot. And, you know, Michael developed that, you know, when he got to the NBA. Len had one of the prettiest jump shots I'd ever seen. And he was a tough, you know what, on the court. And that combination, I just said, I used to say Chris Mullin, you know, who became a Hall of Famer. I said he was still a boy when he went to the NBA, you know, in many ways, you know, and developed a great game, obviously, himself. Len was a man. He was unbelievable, you know, in terms of physicality and just attitude and skill, you know. One thing he didn't do as well as Jordan, obviously, he didn't drive to the basket as well, but that's something he could have, you know, perfected again and go into the team that he was going to, you know, with Bird and McHale and Parrish. I mean, that would have been unbelievable for him and for them.
You came in, right, like you said, right during the time when Len was at his best, you know, because I spoke to a number of people before and they just talked about the development that he had over the years throughout at Maryland. Like, what was some of your bet? I mean, I heard so many stories. Obviously, I didn't have a chance to watch him play back then, but I've seen tapes and the highlights and, you know, like things like you said. So, and I always asked, I had Keith Gatton on, and he spoke about you know, the Lynn Bias and Jordan type of matchups, or how that was just even planned for. Like, I talked to Tony Massenberg, and he was just saying how, you know, just being on the court with him, you know, you're watching him as he performed and puts on a show. I know you kind of touched on it a little bit, but what was kind of like your experience, like just seeing that at that time? And if, you know, things were different and he was in this era right now with the Michael Jordan, is it the same conversation? Because everybody I hear, you know, them bias in the past, you know, Michael Jordan who, or, you know, so what are your thoughts on that? And yeah.
Well, the one thing I regret is I came a couple of seasons too late that I never saw the Jordan bias on the court rivalry that had happened, you know, a couple of years before when Len was a sophomore, Michael was a junior, and that famous game at College Park, Carolina won, but Bias scored 21 points and people didn't, or 21 or 24 points, but people didn't really know who he was at that point. And that was sort of his coming out for somewhat of a ACC audience, national audience. And then when he won he led Maryland to the only ACC tournament title that left, you know, under Lefty, and playing against Duke in the finals and dominating the second half of that game like he did, I think people understood how great a player this guy was. We were writing these anniversary stories 10 years after his death and 20 years after his death, 30 years after his death. I mean, that's how relevant a figure he was that we were kept doing these stories. And 20 year anniversary, I spoke to Jan Volk, who was the GM of the Celtics at the time, and made the case. And obviously he believed that, but others believed it too, that he would have been, because of the team he was drafted by, his talent, and had he stayed healthy, he would have been at least some sort of rival to Michael Jordan. I'm not saying he would have been better than Jordan, but he would have been in the, as you said, in the conversation. You know, John Sally talks about it, and John Sally played on those. He was the same year as Len, played, great player at Georgia Tech, played a long time in the NBA, was with the Bad Boys when they won it. Well, the Bad Boys were the team that took over for a short run after the Celtics dynasty sort of crumbled under the, you know, injuries and age, and not having a guy like Len Bias, and obviously then Reggie Lewis sadly passing away a few years later. But, you know, without question, Sally said, the conversation would be different today if Len Bias had lived and lived up to his expectations.
Right. Now, and you obviously, during his passing, the transition that Merlin went through and the everything that happened around it, what was your experience like in just that field? Like, I hear sometimes some people I know that's former Merlin players, or was that in Merlin around the time, they don't want to talk about it. Or some people they still feel that emotion of that when things happen and just the feel around on campus and just even in the area period, you know, I heard, you know, the funeral was thousands in attendance, and it was just a crazy feeling during those times.
Yeah. You know, I tell the story about being, I was not covering basketball that week, that, you know, going into the draft, I was also the golf writer for the Sun. So I was having a good old time on Long Island at a very fancy golf club and enjoying being out there. My wife came out with me, and we had a 2-week vacation planned after the US Open was over, which was that Sunday. And this happened on, the draft was Monday, and this, you know, he died Tuesday morning. And you know, I wrote stories. I came back for the you were talking about, the memorial service at Cole Fieldhouse, you know, where Jesse Jackson spoke and Red Auerbach spoke, and Lonice Bias was unbelievable. You know, I remember saying to her about a month later, she invited the media out to the house in, you know, where they live in PG County. And I said, I said, you know, if this happened to me, I don't think my mom could have handled it the way you did. you know, the strength she had, and you know, that had to do with her faith a lot. And then tragically losing Jay a few years later, you know, but you know, covering that was it was the hardest. It was the hardest time to be a both a reporter and a, you know, you try to be a compassionate person, you know, and as well as a reporter. And I remember going out to Cole Fieldhouse, and you talk about Keith Gatlin. I remember talking to Keith, you know, this is in August. This is 2 months later. They were trying to get some normalcy back in their lives. Reporters are chasing them all over campus. They're chasing them all over, you know, and the basketball court was sort of their sanctuary. And Keith just breaking down. And, you know, he and I developed a very close relationship that exists to this day. We still speak. And no, it was really hard. I did a story 10 years after. And one of the people I talked to was Dave Dickerson, who at that point was just at the beginning of his coaching career. Yeah, I forget where he was. He was either, I think he was at maybe at Radford at that point as an assistant coach. And he talked about, at that point, he had never worn his college ring because he didn't want to talk about, if somebody saw that he went to Maryland and what the year was, you know, because he was a freshman on that team, he didn't want to have to talk about it. And, you know, you know, years later, when he became an assistant at Maryland and then was part of Gary's staff when they won the championship in 02, I remember seeing Dave in the locker room at the Georgia Dome. And, you know, I said to Dave, even Gary doesn't understand what this means in the full context of having been there when all this happened. And he said, no, he doesn't. You know, he understood it as a Maryland alum. He understood it as a coach because he had to rebuild the program after Bob Wade. But he didn't understand the emotion. I mean, Dave was just, I mean, it was very emotional then. And it still is. I mean, and you know, when I look at the tape of Bias now, when they play, you know, tape of him last summer when ESPN did the 30 for 30, they did the Last Dance series. In the middle of it, they had a 3-hour remembering Len Bias, and they showed that game. And that was really the first time I had ever seen that game. And it just brought back all these memories. And it's sad to watch a guy who was that great, and he never got a chance to show his skills in the NBA.
And they recently just put him in the Hall of Fame at Maryland. What are your thoughts on that? And do you think it was long overdue? I mean, obviously, but what are your thoughts on that? And now, obviously, he's now in the Hall of Fame. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he just was put into the College Basketball Hall of Fame out in Kansas City, and then when he was put into the Maryland Hall of Fame back in I guess it was 2014. You know, I did, again, I wrote about why it took so long. And it took so long because there were people, you know, according to the standards of the criteria to get into the Maryland Hall of Fame, you couldn't have done anything to embarrass the university. And people, there were people on the committee, there were former athletes, you know, from years ago who were on the committee who held him to that standard. And, you know, it really sort of showed how short-sighted they were. I'll leave it at that. But, you know, to say that Len Bias shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame because he made one really, really tragic mistake. He didn't, you know, it would be one thing if he was a drunk driver and killed somebody, you know, but this is, you know, this was something he did to himself and to his family and everything like that. But it really, I mean, yes, Maryland was affected by his death, but to exclude him, purposely exclude him for all those years was shameful.
Yeah. Now, like I said, I talked to a number of people, and like you said, long overdue. Now, with all this transitioning that's going on now in Maryland, What were some of your, let's kind of go back, what were some of your most memorable moments covering Maryland basketball? Obviously, we could talk about, you know, the 2002 National Championship, you know, because it's the first one ever. But also, man, Keith talked about, you know, the ACC Championship when they beat Duke, you know. So what were some of your best moments? Like, it was just like a one of those moments and you just always talk about or bring up in conversation.
Well, I'll tell you one, a couple as a reporter, and then I'll tell you a couple as a dad, because my kids grew up rooting for the Terps. My older son idolized Joe Smith. My younger son actually wore number 3 for Juan from the time he first played basketball through his fraternity college days at South Carolina. He had to have number 3. Okay, that's that, you know, but let's go back to the reporter first. You know, I mean, starting '85 with you know, covering Lefty Driesell, who obviously I obviously knew who he was and heard about, and I had an unbelievable time covering him. He was just such a colorful character, great quotes, you know, and the team wasn't maybe as good as it could have been that year, having the best player in the country, but. You know, that team started 0-5 in the end, and partly because the ACC was so good. They started 0-5 in the ACC that year and then fought their way back. You know, they beat sort of the comeback for them to get into the tournament began on a Thursday night game at NC State. And by, I don't know the point total, but I can't remember exactly, but I remember Lefty giving me a hard time in the locker room because I was sort of questioning their performance and their effort or whatever. And he was sitting there with a big cigar, unlit cigar in his mouth, just, you know, ragging on me. And then 2 days later, the next day, we find out that Len, along with Jeff Baxter and John Johnson, had been suspended for breaking team rules. As it turned out, they had gone out with some NC State players after the game and broke curfew. And I remember, you know, we were stalking the team bus because we beat them back to Clemson. They were going to Clemson. It was one of those Thursday, Saturday turnarounds. And as the bus pulled up, we were right behind them. And as they got off the bus, there were 3 reporters standing there ready to ask questions. And, you know, they lost that game without bias. And then I think there was one other game they got suspended for. And then right after that, they come back, they're playing at the Dean Dome, right? Brand new. I'd been at the first game between Duke and Carolina down there. And I came back for the Maryland game and nobody expected Maryland to win that night. And that was Bias's famous 35-point game with the turnaround steal and turnaround dunk. And then the blocking Kenny Smith shot. And Keith Gatlin making a play, talking about Keith Gatlin, the last basket of the game, they were guarding the inbounds pass with Kenny Smith's back to the basket. And Keith threw it off, you know, and that's like I'm from Brooklyn. That's like a New York staple, you know, that play. And I had covered Kenny Smith at Molloy High School in Queens when I worked in New York. So I knew Kenny well. And I gave him a hard time, like, how do you give that? You're from New York. You don't know that play's coming. And, right. You know, you got beat by a guy from North Carolina on that play. Like, how does that happen?
Right.
You know, and so that was, you know, and then there was also the Duke game that year where Gatlin was out. Gatlin had the flu or back injury or something. And without his point guard, Bias scores 41 points. And, you know, Mike Krzyzewski to this day said it was the greatest single performance by a visiting player ever at Cameron Indoor Stadium.
Wow.
But let me go back to tell you about being a Terp, you know, like I had to be balanced between, as a reporter, you can't be a fan. And I wasn't, you know, and I really, you know, and at that, by that point when Gary had it rolling, I was not covering the team. I was covering, I used to cover a lot of Duke games and tell my kids how great guys Shane Battier and Jay Williams and Elton Brand were. And they'd say, no, they play for Duke. We hate them. You know, there's no way they're good guys, you know? Sure. Even J.J. Redick, I got along with J.J. pretty well. And so there was one day where I got tickets to a Duke Maryland game, and I didn't, you know, I didn't tell my kids. And the younger one was playing in a rep game that morning, and I pick him up and I said, let's go for lunch. You know, maybe we'll find some place to watch the Maryland game. So I keep driving, and my older one at that point sort of understands the topography of Montgomery County. And he realizes that, hey, where are you going?
Right.
I pulled two tickets out of my pocket, and I said, college, three tickets. I said, we're going to Cole Fieldhouse, guys. And they just went crazy in the car, and, you know, and they won that game too. It was one of the games they won it, you know, at Cole against Duke. So no, there was, in fact, when I wrote a book in one of these niche books called 100 Things Maryland Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. It's 100 stories about Maryland basketball. And back in 2016, and part of the dedication was, well, dedication was to my wife, Judy, who watched grown men cry in Atlanta because she didn't understand why everybody was crying after they won the championship. And to my sons, Jordan and Russell, who grew up hating Duke. That was the dedication. And to this day, they're not as big sports fans. My younger son lives in Israel. Older son lives in Brooklyn. And they're, you know, they don't follow it like they used to, but I think they still hate Duke.
Right. I mean, I think once you're a Maryland fan, you got to hate Duke, even when they're not even the ACC no more and they don't even play Maryland, but it's always that thing, that rivalry. You don't, if you're a Maryland fan, you cannot like Duke. Then Dave Ungrady, he did a lot of reports and he wrote a book about Len Bias. And recently he just did a podcast where he had a number of former players, coaches, and individuals come on to talk about, you know, basically remembering Len Bias. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I've known Dave for years, and we were never, you know, the funny thing is, the only time we really sort of communicated on a regular basis is we have the same birthday. And we always wish each other a happy birthday in May. And so the day after I announced on Twitter that I was leaving the paper, he called me and he said, I'm starting to do a documentary on Len Bias based off my book. Would you like to join me? You know, I basically sounded interesting. I didn't, you know, given the timing of me leaving the paper, I still wanted to do things, and I didn't want to just say, okay, I'm retired. And so we started working on a documentary, and we talked to, in fact, when Maryland had game day late February, February 29th, 2020 against Michigan State, we went over there, you know, with the camera and interviewed. We interviewed Jay Billis, interviewed Scott Van Pelt, shows up, you know, as you wouldn't be surprised, he does up for game day, and, you know, some Maryland fans, and that started. Well, you know, a couple of weeks later, that shut down, and we were having trouble trying to figure out how to do this documentary, and we got some interest from a company called Octagon, in a pretty big sports management company in Northern Virginia, and in conversations, Dave and the producer who we've been working with said, hey, why don't you try to do a podcast first? So that started about a little over a year ago. And we interviewed probably 60 or 70 people. And earlier this month, the first episode came out, and it's a very in-depth, you know, really, you know, long look at, it's called Born, Dave's book was Born Ready, The Mixed Legacy of Len Bias. It's based on his book. It's called Len Bias, A Mixed Legacy. And it can be on Apple and, you know, Spotify and all these other apps you can get podcasts on. And it really goes deep into his legacy, who he was, what happened, and why all these years later, people are still interested in talking about him.
Right. And I think that's key too, you know, obviously, growing up in the area, and we talk Maryland and Maryland basketball, you mentioned Len Bias, you think about Len Bias. I was overseas in Ukraine, and we're before we have film, ESPN is on, and they show they talk about Len Bias and his legacy. And but every time when you speak of him, you talk about the tragedy that happened, obviously, because that was a big thing. But it kind of don't really talk about his game that much. They always talk about the tragedy behind what happened, even though, like I said, that was big news and it was a tragedy. But it kind of, you forget about the person, and then you forget about the basketball player as well, you know, because I heard he was a charming person. I heard he was a good guy, you know, always got along with people on campus, you know, a friendly guy, and then obviously a great basketball player. And I think because of how things happen at the end of his life, it kind of, you kind of forget about the person and the basketball player for a second, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, I didn't know Len well, because if, you know, it's when you, when you cover somebody for 4 years, which is a rarity these days, you know, at Maryland, I was figuring out at one point, the only guy I had covered for 4 years, you know, in this, you know, back in the day when I covered, you know, even Keith Booth, I was off the beat for, you know, his junior year, best senior year, but I knew Keith really well. I knew Joe Smith in those 2 years really well. And I still, to this day, you know, speak to Dwayne Simpkins, and I have a regular conversation with Dwayne, you know, and, you know, with Bias, with Len, I was only there senior year, you know, I was a new guy. But I think the interesting, you know, thing was, you know, when you ask questions as a reporter, people can get a pretty good idea if you know basketball or not. And I think that has always, you know, that's always helped me with coaches I don't know, or with players I don't know. And, you know, I don't know if he read everything I wrote or even anything I wrote, but just by the questions I asked him, I think he understood that I knew who he was. I really loved his game. But, you know, at the end of the season, I was trying to do a long interview with him, because he was going to be ACC Player of the Year. He was in the conversation, serious conversation for National Player of the Year. And, you know, so I needed a long interview, and it just never worked out. And finally they played at Wake Forest, and in those days, the team traveled commercially. They didn't have their own plane. And so I was on the same plane the next morning out of the airport in Greensboro. And the plane got fogged in, and so we were there in the airport at the gate. And I don't know if I'm trying to think when he passed away, but Joe Blair, who was the longtime SID gentleman, you know, great guy. He comes over to me and he says, "You got a captive audience. He's ready for you." So I walked over to Len, and he's looking, seeing me coming, and big smiles on his face. And I said to him, "Len, I just want to tell you one thing," because he didn't make it easy for us. He would hide in the training room sometimes, and you know, he'd say, "Talk to the other guys." But I knew, you know, as you said, he was a good guy. And I went to him, "Len, I just want to tell you, you've been a pleasure to watch and a pain in the ass to cover." And he laughed and he said, "Yeah, I figured you'd say something like that. You're always honest." And, you know, and then this is a follow-up to that. So the story comes out, and he's wearing a beautiful necklace that his mom had given him for Christmas in the picture, you know. And by that point, this is a few weeks later, something else had happened. And he wasn't talking to the print media. He was still doing TV interviews, but he wouldn't talk to the beat guys, women who were on the team, covering the team. So he comes over and very respectfully says, "You know, Mr. Marcus, can I get a picture of that? Can I get a copy of the picture of the story in the paper? Because that necklace meant so much." And I said, "Sure, Len, no problem." I said, "It'll cost you two questions though." And he laughed and he answered a couple of questions, and people would say, "Like, how do you get him to talk to you then, you know, the next day?" And I said, "Well, we bartered a little, we made a trade." And I got him the picture, you know, and that, you know, and I think about that when I think about Len, you know, those interactions with him. And that's the thing. One of the stories I wrote when he passed was he was, you know, the most uncomfortable thing he had to do was talk to us after games. That he didn't like doing that. He really didn't like that. He wasn't comfortable talking about himself and things like that. And in Boston, he wouldn't have had to do that, at least at the beginning, because and he would have had a, he could have learned, you know, how Bird handled it and McHale and Dennis Johnson. And that, that, you know, and he would have, you know, he would have been able to, you know, he would have been fine, but the pressure of that responsibility would have been off his shoulders. And I think he would have enjoyed that.
Right. Absolutely. I think more stories of, you know, the person that Lynn was is always good to hear. And I'm glad you guys are doing that with Dave Ungrady with the podcast. Now people can hear their interaction with him or their friendship with him. And that way, you know, you can hear more positive. Obviously, you got learning lessons from that, but you got also, you get to also know the person, you know, not just the basketball player as well. But before we move on to talk more about Terp basketball, let me tell you guys a little bit about our partners over at Bet River Sportsbook. If you haven't signed up with Bet Rivers yet, now's the time, because they are offering a $250 match bonus for your first deposit. But what sets them apart, that they require just one pay through to turn your bonus into cash money. With their new Rush Pay instant approval, withdrawing your winnings is easy, safer, more secure, reliable with basketball season tipping off. If getting on the action by going to BetRivers.com today or by downloading the BetRivers app, must be 21 years older. Gambling problems, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Now, with everything that's going on with the Terps basketball now, obviously, it was interesting because I was just having a conversation with a group of people the day before, and they were talking about, you know, Coach Turgeon and, you know, since he's been at Maryland, what he's done. I know Coach Turgeon. Always had a good relationship with him. Every time we interacted, you know, always welcomed me back on campus, be a part of the program. Stat-wise, I mean, you know, pretty good coaching career at Maryland. But now you have the change right during the beginning of the season, which is, like you said, I didn't see that coming. If anything, I would thought probably after the season, if anything. But the mid-season change, I haven't seen anything like that. I don't think a lot of people on Maryland, they never, I mean, but what are your thoughts on that? With that happening the way it did, and even now, what are your thoughts on that?
And yeah, you know, I was pretty detached from the situation because I wasn't out there, wasn't covering. But, you know, I went out, interestingly, the only time I saw them play in person this year, I went out because the Baltimore Sun did a story on Dave and myself about the podcast. So we went out and took a picture upstairs, you know, at the concourse, on the concourse at the Xfinity Center by Len's picture, you know, which is pretty prominent out, up there. And so I went down and watched the first half of the Hofstra game. And I just saw a team that was, it almost looked like an AAU team put together. You know, it just didn't look like the pieces fit together. And I didn't know if that was, it's early in the season, but you know, you have a lot of time to prepare and become a team. And I really never, you know, for all the, you know, ups and downs Turgeon's teams had, you know, at different times, and they, you know, they were, you know, pretty successful overall. I had never seen a group so, you know, just put together in a way that he said, I don't know if this is going to work, you know, with a point guard, Fats Russell, who was playing 100 miles an hour, and then a back to the basket center who I didn't think they were utilizing enough. And then other pieces that just didn't, you know, Eric Aiello, who I really became close with while I was covering the team, just, he just looked out of sorts. And I said to the PR guy, I said, I think they're in for a long year. And then after that, this was after they had lost to George Mason. And then before they had lost a couple of games, you know, and then the Virginia Tech game. And, you know, the night after the Virginia Tech game, Dwayne Simpkins left a message for me and called me and said, you know, this vitriol against Turgeon, is it for real? You know, is anything going to happen? And I texted him back saying, I think something's going to happen after the season if they don't, you know, get it together, but not now. It's, you know, it's still really early. And the next morning, I happened to be down, we're down in Florida, and I ate something bad. I was in bed. I didn't feel well. And I get a text message from a former student. I teach at American University. I teach sports writing. And one of my former students used to cover Purdue. And he sent me a text saying, did you see this? And it was a Twitter feed from John Rothstein or Jeff Goodman or somebody like that. And I said, oh my God. For the next 2 hours, my phone didn't stop ringing. And my wife said, boy, you recovered. You're talking about this and everything. I had never seen anything, you know, come, you know, especially with just had to do with basketball. It didn't have to do with, you know, a coach getting a DUI or, you know, abusing a player or a guy who had just been losing all the time. And this is a guy who went to the NCAA tournament last year and you know, had a really good team the year before. But at the same time, I still, at my advanced age, I still play ball. And a lot of guys I play ball with couldn't stand Turgeon. Didn't know him, but couldn't stand him as a coach. And you know, I defended him for a long time. And then last few years, I sort of got it. You know, I the way I described it to people was, I think he did a good job overall. But if you're a Maryland fan, the ceiling is the second round. You know, he's not a guy who's going to get you to the Sweet 16 on a regular basis, if at all. You know, there was only one Sweet 16 appearance. You know, my feeling about the 2019-20 team, which I covered until February, but then I still was watching every game, and was that I didn't think I think in some ways he dodged a bullet, because I thought that team was a third foul on Jalen Smith in a second round game or a first round game away from losing, because that at that point, you know, it was basically Anthony and Jalen and some, you know, depending on the day, Aaron and Eric. But I didn't think that team had enough depth. And they were, you know, one of the reasons they struggled at the end of the year. You know, they lost, they had a 3-game lead with 5 games to play in the Big Ten. Yeah, the schedule was a little tougher and everything like that, but they ran out of juice. They ran out of gas because Anthony was playing 37 minutes a game. I think he set the record. He broke, I forget whose record he broke, but he broke the record for minutes a game, average minutes a game in a season. That's a lot. I think he averaged like 37.5 minutes a game. For a point guard who has the ball in his hands so much as Anthony did, that's all. And being his size, that's a lot of, you know, that's a long year. So I understood, you know, I got it. And again, Mark's a good guy, had a good relationship with him. I think he's a good coach, but I think Maryland fans have a higher standard. You know, Gary and Lefty set the bar pretty high. And I also think Maryland fans can be a little unrealistic at times, you know? So I think that, you know, there's sort of this struggle. But I also think style of play fits into it. I think they need somebody, you know, I think Mark's style of play, you know, he tried to play fast at times, but he never went all the way in. You know, and I didn't understand why they didn't play zone more or press more, you know, things like that. And he just played the same way year in, year out. And it was successful. He had a good record and he did well in the Big Ten. You know, he did fairly well in the Big Ten, consistently well, got to the tournament. You know, that at a lot of schools, that would be enough. At Maryland, that's not enough.
I mean, yeah, I would have conversations with, you know, I'll go on a radio show or a podcast, or I'll be at the tailgates and I'll speak to, you know, fans, and they ask my thoughts on Coach Turgeon and what I think. And honestly, I look from two sides though, as a as a player, then also I get where you guys are coming from, you know, but it's like, it was always, especially more recently, they just, like you said, they wasn't happy. And I think that my thoughts are, you know, things went down the way they went down. Like, he left Missy because, you know, I'm hearing he's getting booed at games now. It just wasn't, I think he kind of knew it was kind of done, and he didn't want it to be a distraction to the players and everything going on. I think that was part of it, I believe. I'm not, you know, saying that it is, but I mean, if it's that distraught and things are not working out the way it is, you know, maybe it's time, especially if you going in, you're doing your job and things are looking the way they're looking, you reevaluate the situation, you know. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think that, you know, I got to know his family pretty well. I got to know his dad when his dad used to show up at practice, and back in the day where I got to go to some practices, and you know, so I once, you know, I did a story on Juan Dixon years ago when he found his, you know, biological father, and he before that, you know, Juan said he used to tell Coach Turgeon, you know, he'd like that kind of relationship, you know, with his dad, which he now great, you know, it's great. I think he does have that, you know, with his dad. And I got to know his wife real well. And I went, I spent a day, an afternoon with them watching Will, their son, play a game of Catholic, you know, his freshman year. Or sophomore year, I guess it was. But there was also the reporter side of me that wrote about all the, you know, late collapses and the inexplicable losses. So, you know, our relationship was, it was personal, but it was also professional. But I saw what it was doing, you know, and not just this year, but, you know, a few years ago when a fan yelled out something after a game, they lost a tough game at Seton Hall at home. And somebody yelled something to Mark that I don't know if he heard, but Will heard. Will at that point, I think, might've been in high school, maybe freshman year of college. And he was in tears, you know, and even early in their, early in his tenure, when they were still in the ACC, there was a game against Virginia where they got just crushed at home in one of his first seasons. And they were booing and yelling things about him. And the kids were young. Ann had to take the kids out of the arena, and she's pretty tough. I mean, she's really been a coach's wife a long time, but I know, you know, that she was hearing stuff. People were saying things to her. Supposedly, they were leaving notes on Mark's car, and it became personal. And he didn't want his family to go through that. And I get that, you know, he wanted to protect his family. Not only, yeah, I agree that he probably felt that he, you know, wanted to protect the kids from being this distraction, let them play, you know, with a coach who's not going to be the target. But also I think that, you know, he was protecting his family, and he just said, you know, this is enough. It's gotten too personal. And that's what he said, you know, I think it would have been really hard just based on what I've seen so far. I don't think this team was going to turn around. I don't think they were, you know, maybe make the tournament, but this didn't look like a Sweet 16 or didn't look like a tournament team, let alone a Sweet 16 or a Final 8 team. And I think even if they had made the tournament and lost early, I think he would have been gone.
Right. So now you have this mid-season change. It's happened right before they got into conference play. So they had got a little time to kind of try to get things going. They had a big win against Florida. I thought was necessary and needed for confidence reasons, and trying to, like, kind of, you know, Coach Manning being a former player as well, just bringing the players together and coming together during this time, because it's crazy. You have transfers coming in. You have the coach that left Missy. So now, you know, Ayala is about to leave. So you want to make the best out of the situation that you possibly can, given the circumstances. And now you have that, but now you have this COVID situation. Do you think you probably think it's going to be tough because of the team, but do you think it's possible that they could turn around, you know, given the experience that they do have? A lot of things, your goal is to figure it out before conference play as much as possible. And then January comes, you should be, or you will want to be kind of more gelled together, or any issues that you may have had, you're fixed. That's what you're hoping to see. So what are your thoughts on that? And do you think Coach Manning can get them to at least get into the tournament and at least kind of give some kind of hope? Or is it just, all right, it's possibly this is a wrap for this season and just focus on finding the coach and then preparing that for next season, basically?
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up the whole situation with COVID. I just was before I started talking to you guys. I read that the NHL is, you know, closing. It's shutting its doors for a few days just to sort of get a hold on the situation. We'll see what happens with the NBA. You know, I remember, you know, I not necessarily being a part of it last year at Maryland with what they were going through, but I had in my classes at AU, I had a kid named Jameer Harris who's now playing. He started at Minnesota. He went to American for a couple of years, and now he's finishing his career back home in Jersey. Seton Hall, I had a woman, Taylor Brown, on the women's team, and what they went through last year and how disjointed the teams were and the schedules and everything, you know, because the colleges, you know, were it's a different situation than the pros. So, you know, if all of a sudden we're back and things are closing down, I think it's going to be very hard for Danny Manning to get any traction with this team because he hasn't been around very long. I think the only hope there is that things stay fairly normal and he can build these relationships and put the team together the way he wants, because I think, you know, the little he's, you know, the two games that he's coached, you know, I saw part of I didn't see any of the Florida game. I didn't see any of the Northwestern game. I saw part of the Florida game. But he's, you know, one of the questions I wanted, you know, I was sort of paying attention a little bit, is you have, you know, Julian Reese, who's gotten off to a pretty good start as a freshman. And you have the big guy, Q, I never could pronounce his name right, but Wahab. But, you know, why don't play those two guys, especially against those smaller teams? Why weren't you playing those two guys together? You know, and you know, played Sticks and Bruno together, you know, and that turned out pretty well. So I'm not saying they're Sticks and Bruno, but I'm saying, you know, if they have complementary skills. So to do that under normal situation, I think he'll be able to, you know, maybe get this team playing together. I think one of the things he did the other day, apparently, again, I was watching the game at my, you know, family who lived down in Florida. So I wasn't watching it that closely, but it looked like he was playing Eric Moore on the ball and letting Fats play more off the ball as a scorer, and that worked better. So maybe he's starting to figure out some things that work better for this team. But if COVID comes in and interrupts the schedule, or, you know, all of a sudden they shut down, they can't practice for a week or two, and then all of a sudden they're playing Big Ten games again, you know, they're going to play. They proved last year they could play a schedule, right? You know. And I think last year, one of the things that helped Maryland win some of those road games, honestly, was the fact that there were no fans in the stands. You know, if they were playing, you know, at Purdue at Mackey Fieldhouse, which is Mackey Arena, which is one of my favorite places in the Big Ten. It's sort of like, it almost is like Cameron. It's bigger, but it has the same intimate, tough, you know, crazy feel. You know, would they have won a game there? You know, so I think that's all going to, you know, play into it. And we don't know the answers to that. You know, we don't know the answers to that. And, you know, coaches test positive, you know, for COVID. You know, what happens if all of a sudden Danny Manning, hopefully, you know, God forbid, but hopefully he doesn't. What happens if he tests positive? You know, Coach Loxley had tested positive last year. I think it was during the summer. but it, I don't think it affected him during games. But there's so many variables out there now, again, sadly, again, that we don't know. But, you know, if everything stays the same, you know, I don't know. I think, you know, again, the Big Ten, from what it looks like, is good, but maybe not quite as good as people thought, because, you know, maybe the teams like Minnesota beating Michigan a couple of weeks last week, or Illinois beating, or Rutgers beating, you know, Rutgers beat Illinois, I guess, with that buzzer shot. You know, it gives hope to Maryland, that Maryland sort of in that group of teams that are not expected to do anything, and maybe they will.
With the coach change, who do you see, or what kind of coach do you see can come in and change things around for Maryland? What kind of coach do Maryland need right now at this point?
That's a really good question. And I think about all different kinds of categories. Like, if you want the fan base to get fired up, and I think that's important. You know, Kevin Willard up at Seton Hall has a great reputation, but is the Maryland fan base going to be like embrace him right away? You know, like years ago when Ralph Regan left and was fired, and they were talking to a bunch of people, and one of the names was Mike Leach, who is a very successful but very controversial, and runs a unbelievable, you know, this air raid offense. I said, if you want to fill seats at Bird Stadium, hire Mike Leach. Cross your fingers, hire Mike Leach. In this case, you need to fill seats at Xfinity Center. So who will they embrace? Now, one name I know has been put out there, you know, by fans is Steve Blake. But, you know, and you know, he, and just in terms of personality, knowing Steve a little bit, you know, he sort of, you know, fits sort of the mold of Turgeon, because he's a former point guard, feisty guy. But I think he's even feistier, you know, than I guess John Gilchrist, and he can attest it to Steve's feistiness. Were you on that team? Were you a freshman that year?
Yeah, I came in. Me, John, Chris, Nick.
We all right. So you were there. You were there. I mean, we heard about that fight years later, but yeah, that must have been interesting. But yeah, and I love John too. I've gotten to know John over the years. But, you know, so you have a Steve Blake, you know, who would be embraced by the old, you know, the hardcore old Maryland fans' ties to, you know, the championship team. You know, I think Juan, you know, if Juan hadn't been coaching or been an assistant coach somewhere and didn't have the record he did at Coppin, and that, I'm not saying that's a tough job, that you know, that might be a tough sell, but Blake could be a tough sell because he hasn't been, you know, he's now out of the NBA, he hasn't been coaching. You know, if you want to, I think one of the names I like, one of the guys I like, is Andy Enfield at USC, who plays an up-tempo offense, who right now they have the number five recruiting class in the country. They're unbeaten. I don't know if he would come here. I think there's interest on both parts, you know, both sides from what I hear. He went to Maryland grad school. He played at Johns Hopkins, and he coached in the NBA, and he was an assistant coach in the NBA and at Florida State. So I think, to me, he has the kind of profile and the kind of you know, tempo of offense that fans would like. But again, you know, I think Maryland, I think anybody that's not named Mark Turgeon, they're going to embrace and hope, you know. But, you know, it's going to be a big decision for Damon Evans, and it'll be curious to see, you know, how he does it. You know, one of the suggestions is to put Gary Williams in charge of the search, and have Gary pick, you know, really basically pick the new coach. Again, I have no idea how that's going to work, but it's a very big decision, because look at what happened in Indiana a few years ago when Tom Crean, you know, who had more success than Turgeon did, but he also had, you know, his ceiling was higher, but the floor was lower. And they brought in Archie Miller, and everybody said, what a home run hire. They didn't make the tournament for 7 years or whatever it's been. And then they hired Mike Woodson. So it's not you know, the grass is not always greener, and it'll be a big decision for Damon to make the right choice.
Right. And that's I tell people that too, like, it depends what you're looking for in regards to Maryland and the atmosphere and what the fans and what the alums and boosters, what they want in regards to, like you said, just that energy back, just that energy and fill those seats back up. You know, whether it's, I mean, because like you said, it is going to be a big hire. People, all eyes are on Maryland right now to see who they're going to bring in to fill that void. And people always ask me, I'm like, if you want to bring the old fans back and fill up the ring, Steve Blake doesn't sound bad. He don't have that coaching experience, but if you just talking about popularity, just to get the fans back and that energy back. And even like you said, I know you brought up Juan. A number of people have been bringing up Juan, but he's that cop and his record there. But just that energy that like you said, the fans and the people going to embrace immediately. Like, they love Juan. They love Steve. They come back in there. They're going to come to the games and support them however they can. And by them being as big as they are from at Maryland, the recruiting, you can, Juan comes in, be head coach, Steve's assistant coach. Just to get that love back there, I think is very much key, just as big as a key is bringing somebody who can bring winning back to Maryland as well. So I'm curious. It's going to be very interesting. I'm definitely very curious to see who they're going to bring in and how things go about, even just for the rest of the season.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I covered, I didn't really cover Juan and Steve when they were at Maryland on a daily basis. Obviously, I was around for the Final Four and a couple of tournament games and everything like that. But I did cover them with the Wizards, and those two guys are forever, you know, linked. And that would be really interesting if they brought back, you know, but they have to get a guy who can, you know, Steve hasn't recruited, you know, Juan hasn't necessarily recruited this level on a consistent basis, but they certainly would, you know, like, you know, when Michigan brought back Juwan Howard, everybody was questioning that hire replacing John Beilein. And that was and Beilein was a popular guy who left, and they were upset, and they bring in Juwan Howard, and people said, man, that's not going to work. And then Juwan Howard makes a really smart decision. He hires Phil Martelli as one of his assistants. And then he hired, you know, Howard Isaacs, I think, who played with him, in the pros, I guess. And, you know, it's worked out pretty well. You know, it's worked out really well. So, you know, you never know.
And like I said, I think that if you were to bring a Steve O'Wan in, obviously they're going to bring in a big name as an assistant. You bring in those individuals, we're going to get the energy back here. They're going to be embraced. Now you bring in those assistants to help with the recruiting or just with their expertise or experience, a former head coach who still has the experience that wouldn't mind coming in and being assistant. Just, I mean, like you said, it's just all about how they go about doing it and what they're looking for. So it's interesting times. All on Maryland. But Mr. Marcus, I definitely appreciate our conversation. I definitely appreciate you taking time out to join the Go Terps with Travis Garrison on the Field of 68 Networks. I really appreciate it, sir. It was definitely good to talk to you again. Like you said, it's been years. So, I mean, I definitely appreciate your time. And, you know, happy holidays to you and the family.
You too, Travis. It's been great. Thank you very much. And hope the best for your family, too.
Thanks a lot, sir. Appreciate you.